Welcome to the IDC podcast. The IDC promotes independent research on antitrust and competition law and policy issues, being also the point of contact between all those who have a special interest in the area, both in Latin America and globally.
So, hi, Lisa. Thanks for joining us and welcome to the IDC. It's a real pleasure and an honor to have you here on board with us. Today we're having the pleasure of having Lisa Lautwahl at the IDC. Lisa, in May 2020, was appointed Senior Advisor of UK's Financial Conduct Authority. She's a Senior Research Fellow and the Director of the Competition Law Forum of the British Institute of International Comparative Law. Her role at the Institute is to chair the advisory board of the Competition Law Forum, where they host events for its members and get the forum involved in national and international competition policy debates and engage in competition law research. Lisa is also an NGA of the ICN, appointed by the UK Competition Market Authority. She's a member of the International Competition Network's Unilateral Conduct Working Group and the Agency Effectiveness Working Group. And as I understand, you also sit on the advisory board of the Journal of Antitrust Enforcement, edited by Professors Kovacic and Erstraki. I think we could maybe talk about many issues related on competition law and policy with Lisa, but today's objective is mainly to have a small or a short informal conversation with Lisa about the claim she filed in the UK against Facebook. As I understand it, the case argues that Facebook set an unfair price for its UK users. The claim also states that the price set for gaining access to the social network was the surrender of UK users' highly valuable personal data on a take it or leave it basis for use in the network. In return, users, as alleged under the claim, only received free access to Facebook's social network and zero monetary recompense, while Facebook generated billions in revenues from its users' data. This unfair deal, the claim says, was only possible due to Facebook's market dominance. The claim against Facebook is for a minimum, correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa, of £2.2 billion on behalf of 45 million British users. Lisa, once more, welcome to the IDC and many thanks for joining us. Would you like to, before we go to the details, sorry, of the case, I understand this is a standalone claim filed at the Competition Appeals Tribunal in the UK under the opt-out system of these collective actions in the UK. My first question would be, why not filing this against Meta or Facebook at the CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority?
Yeah, so thank you very much, Pablo, for inviting me here today, and thank you for that generous introduction. You're absolutely right. On the 11th of February this year, I filed a claim against Meta, which is now the new name of Facebook. I will continue to call it Facebook because that's what the Competition Appeal Tribunal has decided to do. And your question about why do I take standalone action rather than going to the Competition Markets Authority, the National Competition Authority here, and get them to open a case and then then do follow-on damages. So I have obviously an answer to that question, but before doing so, it might be worth just quickly going back to 2015, where the Consumer Rights Act of 2015 came into force in the UK. And that is the act that allows for these collective actions to take place. And the thinking was at the time that, of course, you can take standalone action like I've done before the court, or you can, following a decision from the competition authority, then take that decision and go down to the court and do a follow-on action for damages. So, of course, the act allows for both. And it was thought, of course, that the majority of cases would be follow-on actions from, you know, when the CMA would have found against the company, that you could then take that and go to the court for damages. It has actually transpired that the majority of cases has become standalone cases. And that's a very interesting policy, not a policy development, but it's an interesting development. And the question is whether that is because the CMA has been too inactive, because of course it requires us to have a decision in order to go to court to seek damages. And I do think that the CMA in general is a very active authority, and they have done a lot of good cases and reached a number of good decisions over the years, but it has taken a tremendous amount of time for them to get from the start to the end. I appreciate that the CMA has limited resources and therefore can't just take all the cases they would like, and it can't do it as quickly as it would like, but nevertheless, the reason why I decided not to go to the CMA was simply because I felt that after they had issued their report in the summer of 2020 on the market study into digital advertising, where if you read that report, which is mainly about Facebook and Google in the digital advertising market, that if you read that whole report, including all the annexes, it is nearly 1700 pages. And after they have criticized heavily Google and Facebook, then they decide to not intervene in the market. So I just thought, clearly they're not interested in this. And therefore I had no desire to go to them, because I thought they were not going to do anything in this space, because this was their golden opportunity to do something in this market. They afterwards said, but that was because the government was considering regulation in this space. And here we are almost 3 years later, and we, no, to be fair to them, 2 years later, and we're nowhere. We're nowhere. We haven't seen the shadow of regulation. The regulation base has issued a proposal. But in a way, that was one of the reasons why I decided I was not going to go to them. Another reason is that this is a case that is about unfair trading conditions. And to be honest, that is something that falls squarely within antitrust law. So if you read Article 102A of the European Treaty, then it talks about unfair prices and unfair trading conditions. And the equivalent law in the UK, the Competition Act of 1998, Section 2 or Chapter 2, has the equivalent unfair prices and unfair trading conditions. And this is what we would categorize to students as exploitative abuses. Of course, neither the treaty nor the Competition Act of 1998 makes the distinction between exploitation and exclusion. But just, it's an easy way of distinguishing between the various conduct. And while the CMA has been active within unfair pricing, within exploitative abuses, it's really a bit of a blind spot when it comes to unfair trading conditions. So I thought, well, if I'm gonna rock up and knock on their door and say, could you please take a case against Facebook on unfair trading conditions, I think they would have slammed the door in my face quicker than I could have cared to think about it. Obviously, that's unfair to the CMA, because of course I never went to them, so I could not have known whether they would have listened to me or not. But having said that, these were the two main reasons. The fact that I felt after they decided not to intervene in the digital advertising space, following their market study that they spent a lot of time and resources on, plus the fact that it was exploitative abuses and unfair trading conditions, I just decided that was probably not gonna fly immediately, and it would take me a long time to convince them. And as time go by, users were not going to get any redress. So that was the reason why I decided to go directly to the court and take standalone action.
Thank you, Lisa. And what do you think would be the how long would it take for the CAT or the CAT to decide on your case? Because you mentioned the time that the CMA might take also on an investigation like this. Well, what about this, the CAT?
Yeah, I know that this argument is biting me a bit in the butt now, right? Because I don't think that the court will be particularly quick either. But having said that, it will definitely be quicker than having to wait for the CMA to do public enforcement and then follow on damages from there. So no matter that it's not going to be a quick quick fix, then I still think it's quicker this way. So, well, to your question about how long time will this now take? So just to give you an idea about the snail pace that's happening before the CAT, I launched this on the 11th of February this year. We are now in July and we still don't know. The only thing that has happened so far is that the CAT has issued a summary of our main arguments. That's a very good summary. It is available on the Competition Appeal Tribunal's website, so people can go in and read the summary there, which is an excellent summary. They have yet to convene a panel to hear the case, so we don't know who the panel members of the court are yet, and there we haven't had a CPO hearing scheduled, a collective proceeding order. In order for this case to go to trial, we need a collective proceeding order, and that needs to be scheduled by the CAT, and that has not yet been scheduled. So right now we are in the process of trying to find some dates with the opposing counsel as to when we can have a hearing. And if we can agree outside court, that means that the Competition Appeal Tribunal will issue some directions, and that will be put on the website. And if we can't agree, then the CAT will have to schedule what's called a CMC, a case management conference, where they bring two parties together and then we find the directions forward. And all of this is quite unlikely to happen before autumn. And I think that it's highly unlikely that the CPO hearing, not that I know much, to be honest, but I think it's unlikely to be before the beginning of 2023. So that is a year from launching this before court. So, I mean, we are not talking about the fast pace. I mean, litigation, of course, was never fast paced. So, but yeah.
Sounds familiar. So almost half a year, not much happened. And as you said, maybe it won't happen a lot until the beginning of next year. Just for those who are not maybe that familiar with UK law or UK competition law, you've said that the CAT, the Competition Appeal Tribunal, needs to get a panel together. As far as I understand, the Competition Appeal Tribunal has a very specific sort of procedural way of working. So each of these panels are get together for each case. Could you just, in a nutshell, give us how this works? How do they elect this, or how they choose this panel?
Yeah, see, I think I probably will not answer that question very satisfactory, because how they put the panel together, I don't know, but it obviously has something to do with availability. It has something to do with whether you have been involved with this case before or not. It's quite clear, because this is quite a big case in a relatively new area, that I would be surprised if we don't see Sir Marcus Smith, who is the president of the CAT, on the case. So I would think that he would be on the panel for sure. But rather to how they pick and choose, I think it has a lot to do with time and also ability. So that's how. But anyway, it's for the court to convene that panel, and I can't intervene in that. That's just something they will decide.
Okay, that's another discussion or another conversation on procedural issues that obviously is not the objective of our chat today. you mentioned the consumer rights 2015 and talking about limitation period, because of, as far as I understand, the damages you're seeking go for the period 2015-2019. Does that
have let me tell you how we work that out. You're absolutely right. The Competition Act of 2015 Rights Act of 2015 obviously have a limitation period, and that means that we could only go back 6 years. So that's a limitation period, and therefore, given that we launched this in February 2022, the earliest start date it could be was February 2016. Despite that the Act came into force in October 2015, we could not go back to that because of the limitation period. And the reason why the claims period for damages is finishing 31st of December 2019 is because we understand that as of 1st of January 2020, that Facebook changed their terms and conditions. And this is not to say this case is not about Facebook's terms and conditions, but it is about, because then that could very easily become a GDPR case, and this is not a data protection case, this is a antitrust case. But this is very much about that. I believe that up until January 2020, that Facebook, they would collect data on their own platforms such as WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook, so facebook.com. But not only that, they will also collect all the data on third-party websites where you use your Facebook login. And in that way, they would then combine what I call first-party data, the data they collect on their own platforms, with third-party data, which is the data they collect on the internet. And then they would then combine first and third party data, and then they could then create a much fuller picture on the individual users. And I understand it, but of course I have to wait until we seek discovery before court, but I understand that as of 1st of January 2020, that users of their platform had the ability to opt out from third party data collection. So this is why the claims period is running from February 16 to December 2019.
And anyway, that's also subject to what is the formal investigation by the court. I mean, or not? I mean, you've said January 2020, but although the terms and conditions changed, if the conduct still continued, would that also be extended or not?
Yeah, I mean, so this is interesting, isn't it? That's a very good question, because if of course, what you can do in the majority of cases, they don't have a finite finishing period, because it's believed that if the harm is continuing, then you're not going to stop it. And what we understand is that very few people has actually used the opportunity to opt out from third-party data collection. But of course, that's one of the problems, is that they won't know how to opt out. So you could argue that the harm is still continuing. But given the fact that if you are savvy enough to know how to opt out, at least you can stop the harm. Or at least Facebook have theoretically made it possible for people to opt out. So yes, but of course, one can say that the harm, but this is a case about the historical abuse of a dominant position, the historical unfair trading conditions that they have imposed in terms of take it or leave it. So if you want to sign up to their platform, then you have to sign up to their terms and conditions, and you don't have a choice not to.
Great, and that brings me to another part of my questions, in the sense of, first, how did you calculate this consumer's losses? In the sense, I mean, as I said, it's a minimum not the maximum, not a specific number, but a minimum of 2.2 billion pounds.
2.3, yeah.
2.3, sorry.
Yeah.
So how did you calculate that? Because it's 45 million people that were allegedly...
So the quantification of the harm is done by our team of economists.
Okay.
And I understand that they are relying on excess profit model, which is an economic model that's kind of fairly well known. So that's how they would do it. They would simply say this is a two-sided market, and what kind of profit have they made in digital advertising? And if they had to pay for data, which is what we're questioning them to do, would they have made the same amount of profit? I mean, so it's the excess profit calculation that my team relies on.
Great, thank you. So going maybe more to the theory of harm that you are applying, could you please spread a little bit more on which is the theory of harm? I mean, and I ask this knowing that you have written even much before you fight this claim about not only Facebook, but also on this type of market and abuse of dominance. So which is exactly or specifically the theory of harm on this case in your...
Yeah, so the theory of harm is that Facebook is dominant in the market for social network. And by not providing their users with a choice, and when I say choice, I mean choice in two aspects. There is a choice of whether you want to sign up to their terms and conditions and in return give up all your data, or a choice to then pay for subscription model. So that's not a choice that users have had. There was nobody who says, actually, I don't want to give away all my data. I would rather pay whatever amount I would need to pay for subscription, a little bit like you pay for newspapers. So they had had none of that choice. And of course, they have no choice of going to another social network with exactly the same features as Facebook. So there have been very little choice in the market as well. So that's why you have a dominant undertaking within the market for social network that is basically depriving its users for choice by imposing unfair trading conditions. So this is the theory of harm. And in short, this is really a case about fairness. This is really about, is it fair, and have they even told their users what they're using that data for and how much data they collect and how they combine those data sources? So by and large, it's a case on fairness.
So in that sense, do you think, we've seen a lot of developments both in the European level with the DMA and also in the UK. You mentioned the digital report. Before that, I think we got the Furman report, the open banks, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, do you think this should be an area in which regulation might help? I mean, are there any market failures that may maybe allow us to think that this should be regulated, or do you think we should leave it as it is?
Yeah, so that's a very good question, because of course that's something the whole world is thinking about at the minute, saying, right, we have, our economy is going digital. There is no going back. All around the world, our economy is becoming digital, and the pinnacle of the digital economy is data. So can it really be right that you have certain companies that was born digital, because of course all companies now need to be digital, but there is a difference between being born digital and then being born analog and having to change from analog into digital. Some of those companies that was born, such as Facebook, that was born digital, would have had a first mover advantage within the data space, and they have very well capitalized on that, which is fine. I mean, there's no problem in being capitalizing on that. But the question is now, and of course it was the Furman review that was launched in or published in March 2019 that paved the way for having a discussion about this. And then, of course, you know all the reports around the world, the ACCC in Australia, you saw the Stiegler Commission in the US, you saw the European Commission Special Advisors, and you know there is a whole list of reports.
I remember 1 or 2 years ago, we had a similar conversation with Simonetta Bezzoso, and she was sharing with us the lots of photos with all the digital reports we had all around the world.
Yeah. Exactly. So we're all familiar with those reports. We know what they're saying, and they're more or less all coming to the same conclusion, which is we need to do something in this space. And antitrust enforcers around the world, I would say, has failed. When it comes to antitrust ex post enforcement against some of these platforms. I'm not saying all they do is bad at all, not at all. I mean, some of them have remarkable business models. We all like to use them on a daily basis. So it's all about proportionality and all about, you know, not abusing their dominant position. But the question is, I think that the majority of the reports concluded something needs to be done. And given that antitrust enforcement hadn't really done much in this space, question marks, should we then do regulation instead? And this is, of course, something that's being debated. And now we, of course, saw that the European Commission came out first with the Digital Markets Act that has now gone through Parliament. And next phase of that is implementation. So they have moved with incredible speed in this. And the question is, as you say, normally regulation comes into a market when you see market failure. And that's something we see in utilities usually, water, gas, rail, electricity, these sorts of things. This is not a market that is homogeneous, like you can talk about the water market or the market for gas or the market for electricity. Here you have a market, if you can even talk about a market, it's markets because every company is digital, but we have some really big digital companies. And the question is, can you really, does it make any sense to regulate them? Because do we see a market failure in the market? And I'm still not quite convinced, because I work for the Financial Conduct Authority, and that is an authority in the UK that regulates financial services market. And in order to operate within financial services market, you need to come to us and ask to be authorized. And if you, when you're authorized, you're under a number of rules and regulations, and you know how to behave and all of these things. I mean, that's not where we are with the gatekeepers. It is not like you need to go to the European Commission and ask, can I be regulated to operate in this space, right? So, and regulation is also often about price control, and it's about so many things. So I sometimes am not quite sure whether you can put these gatekeeping platforms into the box of regulation. I'm not saying, you know, we should just have continued as it was, but whether that is an ideal situation, it's difficult to say, because you may have some antitrust violations within certain markets, but can you say that's a market failure, and across what market? Right. So what I see the DMA is, it seems to be drafted by a number of competition people, and they're using enforcement remedies, I mean ex post remedies. So I'm not quite sure that that the broad brush that they're using at the DMA will be successful, unless they significantly change their mindset, because the DMA is supposed to be regulated by an authority, the European Commission, that has never been a regulator before. So they now have to move from their antitrust ex post enforcement mindset into a regulatory mindset. And I'm no doubt that they can do it. I'm just saying that is a change of mindset. And it would require quite specific regulatory dialogue with these companies. And so Time will be the judge of that. But I can only say that the regulation that they that's being suggested by the government in United Kingdom or by BASE, which is the government department that that's dealing with this, is more that you have individual codes of conduct, because they recognize that Google does not have the same business model as Apple, and Apple does not have the same business model as Microsoft, and Microsoft does not have the same business model as Amazon, just to mention some. Therefore, I think it's very important that one recognizes that these business models are vastly different, and therefore you got to have individual codes of conduct to capture what they're doing. Whether we will have regulation here or not, only time will tell. But I think your initial question about, you normally see regulation where there is a systemic market failure across markets. I mean, what markets are we talking about here? What systemic failures are we seeing here? And this is not to say that I think we should just, you know, throw up everything and then not do anything. But I'm just saying that, that I think this is not the end of this debate. You know, just because we see regulation being enforced, regulation is only as good as the way you kind of adopt that regulation and as good as how you implement that regulation. So having a framework in and of itself obviously is kind of
absolutely, and that's something that we see a lot here in Latin America, and more specifically in Argentina, for example, which we have very very nice law or acts enacted, and sometimes the implementation is definitely not good. So that's in a certain way the public policy fails because of its wrong implementation or the lack of implementation at all. So, I mean, you've talked about ex post, antitrust, regulation, and related with that, do you think interim measures might play a role or an important role on these types of markets?
Yeah, I think that's a, again, interim measure is something that has been discussed along the way, because it's quite clear that regulation, ex ante regulation and ex post enforcement, they complement each other very well. And just because you have regulation does not mean antitrust enforcement will stop, and vice versa. So they go well hand in hand. But make no mistake that regulating these platforms will also take a very long time, and they will initially be teething problems, and there will be a lot of litigation, and will take a very long time. So interim measure is obviously a good instrument in the toolbox that if you're sure what they're doing, that you can go in and stop that. So I do think that there need to be much more active use of interim measures. Absolutely. And that is a tool in the toolbox that neither the European Commission nor the CMA or many other authorities around the world are very willing to use very often.
Yes, and sometimes it's understandable because of the danger, but at the same time, I agree with you absolutely. It's in the toolbox, and it should be used whenever necessary or more convenient. As you were talking about the beginning of the theory of harm and the case, your case or the UK case, the natural or immediate reaction one would have is, what about the German case? But I don't see exactly a parallel here. I think there are different cases. And the other question would be, what about the GDPR? I mean, and I don't see also there any parallel. I think GDPR has one goal or many goals, but are not exactly related with those on the antitrust box or toolbox. So any thoughts on both the German case, that is obviously maybe the case, and the GDPR?
Yeah, okay, so the German case, I assume you refer to the decision against Facebook by the Bundestagsgericht, that was then appealed to the Court of Düsseldorf, that then went to the Supreme Court, that then asked a preliminary question, and we're now waiting to hear from the court. So quite clear, I think that is a case that's very specific to Germany. I think it is a case, they changed their competition law in order to take these data violations into the remit of competition law. So I think it is, but of course, yes, it's the same company, that's right. And it's also the way that Facebook is using its data that the Bundeskartellamt was unhappy about. But what was interesting was the court of Düsseldorf then said, well, this is exploitative abuse and you really need to also see harm on the market. So you also need to have an element of exclusionary abuse in there. And of course, that was what was appealed to the German Supreme Court, and then they asked that specific question on a preliminary reference under Article 234 to the European Court of Justice. But I think it is very, very specific to the German market. So I think there's not many analogies to be made, except for it was a data case against against Facebook. Coming to your second point about GDPR, what I have heard being argued is that if GDPR had been enforced in the right way, we wouldn't see all of the things we're now seeing in these markets. So again, that goes back to our point about implementation, because there's quite a number of good rules in GDPR, and there is, for example, the article on purpose limitation, that when you do take people's data, you are only allowed to use the data for the purpose that you as a user have consented to. And I think that has been violated a number of times. So one could say if there's been a good implementation and a good enforcement on GDPR, would we be where we have been today? But yet again, I don't know the counterfactual, but maybe GDPR couldn't have done the whole thing anyway. But that was a good start. The reason why this is not a GDPR case dressed up as an antitrust case is because I don't think one could. It is the unfair trading conditions that Facebook is imposing upon its user, and that just so squarely falls within competition law. That is even mentioned in the treaty. It's even mentioned in the Competition Act in this country. So it's definitely an antitrust case. And all obviously, it's quite clear if you're a dominant undertaking and you violate other laws along the way, such as GDPR, can that be considered an abuse of a dominant position? So could one say, here we have an undertaking, Facebook, that's dominant and it's violating GDPR. So could that be considered an abuse? It is not a requirement, if you know what I mean. You can violate competition law without having violated any other law. So it's not a requirement that you violate other laws along the way. But of course, a dominant undertaking has a special responsibility. And you can say it's a violation of that special responsibility if it is you're going around violating other areas of law. I kind of like the AstraZeneca case quite a lot. I know it's about a bit an old case now, but that was very much about lying to the patent authorities in order to be able to extend your patent after 20 years, because if you don't have in certain markets, you need market authorization to get in the first place. And if it can take you up to 3 years to get that market authorization, then of course it's not fair that you only have your patent for 17 years. So in that way, it is acknowledged that you can then apply for an extension of that patent, so you didn't lose the period it took you to get market authorization. But in the AstraZeneca, they had been lying to the patent authorities, and that was found to be an abuse of a dominant position, right? Back in the day when that case came out. So in that way, that was found that that was not competition on the merits. And the question here in this case is whether Facebook's unfair trading conditions is competition on the merits.
Great. Going back to the timing and the years it would take maybe for the Competition Arbitration to decide, do you think this might be a case to be decided or closed on the settlement with Facebook, or is that a possible outcome for your?
Of course. You can always settle. I mean, they can always come forward to settle. My role as bringing this case is I represent the class. So I represent the 45 million users of Facebook platforms in the UK. So my interest has to be whatever is best for the class. And if it's best for the class to settle, then a settlement is most welcome. And it's quite clear that that would be quicker than going to full trial. And so in terms of time, and but so to answer your question, yes, settlement is a possibility. But that's, of course, we have already offered them to settle before we filed. They were not interested, and you know, it's for them. They can come forward at any point in time for a settlement discussion, and of course, I would be open to that if it's in the best interest of the class.
Great. I'm going to the class and your role. I mean, I think it's a huge responsibility. And apart from that, what about the funding? I mean, as far as I understand, it's very expensive to file this sort of litigations in the UK. Like, for example, on the other side, the Netherlands, as far as I understand, it's not that expensive. How come, and why is that expensive in the UK? How do you fund these
things? Everything is expensive in the UK.
Yes. Okay.
Well, so you're absolutely right that it is eye-wateringly expensive to litigate.
Yeah.
In terms of everything is just expensive here. I can't really say it in any other way, but that then becomes extremely crucial that you have funding. Because of course, unless you have funding for these cases, this whole damaging regime is not gonna take off, right? So just getting the Consumer Rights Act of 2015 is not in and of itself enough. Because unless you have some funders that are willing to take the risk, and it is a very high risk, right? To pay for this litigation, then you won't. This is not gonna take off. Not in standalone cases, in follow-on actions where you already have a decision from the CMA, then you will still need funding, but it's not gonna be as much as you need in standalone cases. So funding is an absolute crucial part of this.
How do you get the funding in the UK? Is there any system, any legal?
Well, there is a number of litigation funders, and some of them are big, some of them are small. So some of them has to be in a syndicate in order to fund the case. I am lucky in the way that I have funding from Innsworth, which is, of course, a very big litigation funder. So I had to go to one funder only. But how do you get funding? I mean, like, how do you get anything in life? It's all about them believing that is a good investment for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's clear. I wouldn't go into the details of how the funding system works in the UK, but I mean, I think it's very clear that you need that funding. And from there, and you mentioned the damages claim system, I would like to take you to Latin America. Maybe it's not your area of expertise, but I mean, we have been following a very similar track of that of Europe, mainly due to continental law system. And I remember in the beginning of 2004, there was this Usher's report, and then we got the white, the green papers, and all those. And we finally got the directive, damages directive in 2014. And now we are seeing more and more cases, not that much, but I mean, definitely there are much more cases than 20 years ago on damages mainly. And if I do a parallel to Latin America, that's something similar in Latin America. We don't see much cases, very few cases on damages, although we have cases, for example, on cartels, on abuses, but you don't see follow-on actions. So that was a huge discussion we had specifically in Argentina, when we drafted the new Competition Act, and we included a new chapter on damages. Because the discussion there was, you need to have first an administrative decision in order And I was saying, why? If you have an authority that is deciding nothing, for example, or taking 10 years, 15 years to decide, what about the consumers? What about the companies, the competitors? So we needed a standalone, very clear standalone system. But again, we also need a class action or collective actions system that is, needs to be clear, these issues about funding. So making a long story shorter, which would be, if any, the two or three main ideas for a damages system, repair or damages claim system to work in any circumstance, in any jurisdiction, following your experience in Europe and the UK specifically?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it is absolutely key you have funding. It is absolutely key that you have some litigation funders that are willing to back the system. And in order for them to do that, you need to have a clear set of rules. And it's quite clear if your judicial system does not, you know, support that, then funders get nervous because funders, they want clarity around how the system works. And you mentioned the Netherlands before, which also have a well-developed system in the EU, is because they have clear rules. People understand the system, you know, so it's easy, but funding is key first of all. So you need to have a law that allows for collective opt-out, because we haven't spoken about the opt-out and the opt-in distinction. And my case is on an opt-out basis, which basically means that users are automatically in this claim because it would not be considered viable for the individual users to take a case against Facebook. So there is an economic interest and there is a viability issue. And we have, and of course the court will have to certify the class and have to say that it's okay to bring this as on an opt-out basis. But you need to allow for an opt-out system, because otherwise you may not get funding. For example, in Denmark, where I come from, you have an opt-in system where people have to opt in, and I think it's only the ombudsman who can run an opt-out. And I mean, the system is dead, isn't it? I mean, so it's crucial you have the opportunity for opt-out. It's crucial you have funding, and it's crucial that you have a good and clear set of rules that you can trust, and a good interpretation that you trust the judicial system to move this forward.
Lisa, I mean, I think we could stay for ages talking about these issues, not only about the case, but also these general issues. And I don't want to bother you more, because we've also seen lots of cases. You've mentioned the exploitative abuses, not related with the unfairness, but I mean, other mainly high prices, etc., excessive prices in the UK specifically, and also some other countries in the EU. But we've also seen some very recent cases on Meta, Giphy, with the cat upholding CMA's decision, a new case on Apple. But I won't ask you about those cases, because this would be very, very long. So unless you have anything specifically that you want to share with us, from our side, it was a pleasure to have you here at the IDC.
Yeah, and thank you very much for the invitation. It has been absolutely fascinating to have this chat. So I'm most grateful for giving me this platform.